Have you ever wondered why politicians struggle to fulfill their campaign promises, that even after major electoral shifts, they cannot pass whatever legislation they like? This is the Overton window at work. The idea, coined by the Mackinac Center's Joe Overton, explains the range of ideas that are politically acceptable at any time. And on the Overton Window podcast, we look at issues moving from being unthinkable to plausible to policy and talk to the people who change what is possible in politics. Now, my colleague Pat Wright has recently sued the state, arguing that the state constitution requires legislators to get two-thirds approval in both chambers in order to authorize pork projects. Pat, what does the constitution say about district grants?
It says that the all local and private purposes have to appropriations for them have to get two-thirds votes. And that's in Article 4, Section 30. It's been around since 1850.
Is 1850?
Correct. Michigan's had four constitutions. Mm-hmm. There's an 1835 constitution, which is actually 2 years before we became a state. There's an 1850 constitution. There's a 1908 constitution. And there is the current 1963 constitution. There are actually two other constitutional conventions that failed in between. I think those were 1867 and 1873.
So I know it's tough to understand what our 19th century constitution writers may have thought about things, but why is this in the state constitution?
It was meant as a way to prevent what we'll call log rolling, as a way of getting votes. So let's say you get to the end of the budget
log process. Rolling being a really important thing in a lumber state.
Right. I mean, Michigan used to be, before it was a car state, it was a lumber state, and a lot of our lumber was very important in building Chicago. But the concept is that you get to the end of a voting cycle, budget cycle, and you're short. And so what you do is you sprinkle in particular votes for particular lawmakers in order to give them projects to help get their vote. And so as everybody gets more of these, more and more logs get rolled. The idea was by setting it high enough at two-thirds that you would, that it would only be for very important purposes that you would have local or private purposes benefited. The general theory in the 1850 was we wanted laws applying across the state, that the localities would handle their own ordinances and do their own things, and that the state legislatures were supposed to make laws that applied to everyone that lived in Michigan.
Indeed. I actually remember that Cooley case that we talk about frequently. Please check out from our paper on this, but where he says the state can have no favorites. Its job is to give all the benefit of equal law.
From prohibited to permitted is the name of the paper.
Yes. Thank you. But this is a basic principle of constitutional governance, which is we're as a public, we elect people to represent us, and those people need to be focused on trying to discern what is the public purpose, what is the public benefit, what are the laws that are going to make things better for everyone in the state, not just particular people. And so, but it seems like it's a natural tendency when you have people, you know, electing legislators for districts, that they really care about whether their own district comes out ahead.
Well, sure. I mean, and not surprisingly, the politicians are myopic. You know, they live in two-year election cycles. They look at themselves and say, okay, I would like to be here next term. What do I have to do to accomplish that? Mm-hmm. A lot of times that's making sure that things are well taken care of in their own home district. So what does that cost? There's a ton of pressure to do earmarks because you're trying to make sure that what come election cycle that you're, you know, that you've done something and you can, you know, send out something in the mailer to your district that says, yes, you know, I got you the swimming pool or, you know, the art museum is now partially funded by my work or something along those lines.
Which is to show that your legislature did something to benefit you.
Correct.
So the thing we want, right?
Well, there's some pressures in it. Somebody has to pay for it, obviously. Yeah. So not everybody's going to get the same level of earmarks. And this is kind of the root of why we ended up filing the suit. What largely had happened is that these things had kind of plateaued for a while, around the 100 million mark. Governor Snyder had slowed it down, but his last year, I believe it had gotten up to $1 billion, but constitutionally got up to $1 billion. There was the sufficient votes to get up to $1 billion, I believe.
That is, they passed a budget with $1 billion worth of pork projects, but they also got 2/3 approval in both chambers.
That's correct. And I believe that was the last, this was a Whitmer Republican House, Republican Senate bill. The next year we saw
that it had bipartisan support for these pork
projects.
You
had to have the bipartisan support, but this was in a situation where the Republicans had the majority of the House and Senate, and the governor was a Democrat. Okay, but this was, everybody agreed, $1 billion of pork. We got the 2/3 vote, so there was enough minority votes, in this case, Democrats, to do it. And then the next year, unfortunately, for the Constitution, there was insufficient votes, and it was mostly done on a party line basis. Happened to be this time the Democrats were in charge. They did about $2 billion. Most of them, I think we put it out at about 90% went to their home districts. And there was a tremendous amount of pork projects in it. So this got us looking back into this, into the question of earmarks and how we had gotten here. And
$2 billion in state budget terms is a lot. A little less than
$81 billion budget that year, I think. Is that correct?
I don't have that part memorized. Okay. And honestly, the portion that I care most about is the portion of the budget that is sponsored by state resources. So how much is the state taxing? You know, these are the state taxes, and how much?
It was a significant portion of that general fund budget, which is, you know, what you're referring to is the lower, not necessarily federal mandates, but when the state has some discretion to spend.
Yeah. And it's not just the general fund. The general fund is a small portion of all of the state's taxes.
Sure. My apologies. James is better at this part than I am. Then the next year was $1 billion again. And that included these two baseball earmarks that we decided to look at. There was probably a couple hundred earmarks in the 24-25 fiscal year budget. We just decided to pick two because it allowed us to focus on this Article 4, Section 30 argument. It had a nice little benefit in that one was going to be they would challenge the private purpose clause, mm-hmm. and the other one would challenge the local purpose clause because it was actually a governmental entity that ran it. Mm-hmm. And so this would get us a shot at doing both of the two clauses that are within the constitutional provision and make a very nice test case. And so that's why we chose to litigate it that way.
So this has been a constitutional requirement since 1850. Mm-hmm. So a massive amount of time.
Correct.
Has anyone challenged on this?
There have been challenges on Article 4, Section 30 and its analogs in other constitutions. The 1908 and 1850 constitutions would have it under different numbers and different sections. But yes, but the language of it has remained pretty much constant since 1850. There have been challenges. Most of the time up until the 1963 Constitutional Convention, we did almost no earmarks at all. Part of the Constitutional Convention history that we discuss at length in the brief, they are discussing this provision, and they talk about a 4-H club and I think an aeronautical something else. I can't remember. And so these are, you know, the only two earmarks that the committee that was discussing this was really even aware of. So the earmarks, as they're done in the federal government that have kind of worked their way into the state process, those are more of a modern invention. These were not things that were truly at issue much before 1963.
That's interesting. So since 1963, mm-hmm. at least as long as my experience in following Michigan's budget has been, there have always been earmarks.
Correct.
There have always been these district grants where you look in the budget and they say, you know, and they do try and generalize it.
Oh, yeah, I didn't discuss that. The other thing, that, I mean, we spent most of our time so far discussing the two-thirds provision. There is a different constitutional provision, Article 4, Section 29, which discusses general or local acts. Mm-hmm. And it says that if you're going to have a general acts, you're fine. Local acts can be done with a two-thirds vote, but it also requires a vote of the district that you're in. And so
that is, I want to elaborate on that, which is general acts, like anything that applies statewide, that's fine. Just simple majorities, that's great. If it's applying to just one city in Michigan, though, well, you've got to get that two-thirds in both chambers, and then you've got to get that authorized by the voters in that city.
That's correct. So typically where this would come up would be in Detroit-specific legislation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
and where they would have in the state of Michigan, in a city with a population greater than 1 million.
Correct, that's what it started, and they kept having to scale these Detroit-specific things back because Detroit's population has slowly receded, and so it was, you know, it used to be 1 million, then it was 900,000, then it's 800,000, then it was 7, now it's at 6.
A little more than 6.
Yeah, well, you go the other way, but the threshold is 6, so that Detroit can meet it.
Yeah.
But so they developed a body of case law related to this. And so the general rule ended up being that if another city had a shot, a legitimate shot, of reaching this population threshold, then that was a general law, even though everybody knew, wink, wink, that it was just applying to Detroit. Mm-hmm. So what they did then with some of these district grants is they've started being hyper-specific about where the grant was going to apply. So they would do it in between a city of 5,000 and 5,500, in a county of 100,000 to 101,000. Mm-hmm. And that would essentially mean that they had pinpoint targeted it and then kind of reverse engineer this geographical mask in order to kind of hide the earmark and give it this little veneer, extra veneer of constitutionality under Article 4, Section 29. Now, practically to me, it doesn't make a difference because Constitution Article 30 covers it, and that says appropriations. And so the general acts, local act, and local vote question really deals with non-appropriation matters. So if you're going to create a, like a recorder's court, which used to exist for Detroit, if you're going to create a recorder's court, that would
be... what's a recorder's court?
Recorder's court was a Detroit-specific district court system. And it was something that really only applied there and gave them a unique and different manner of deciding some of their cases.
Okay.
But that would have required your two-thirds vote. Again, it might have been that they tried to do the 600,000, 700,000, 800,000, whatever the number was necessary at the time, and say it was just a general act and not need two-thirds. But that's sort of this masking that goes on. That's being challenged, it's being legislatively challenged in the House right now. They just passed a bill.
They approved out of their chamber.
Out of their chamber. A provision that says you can't do it, that you have to have this in the appropriations process. You have to identify your earmarks before we go to conference. So what'll typically happen is, Chamber A, the House, Chamber B, Senate, they each come up with their own budget. They're close, but not quite. They go to conference. Lo and behold, all these earmarks show up. And
which weren't in the previous.
Which weren't in either bill beforehand, which weren't in either version of the bill beforehand. And we get, magically, we find some votes, and lo and behold, the budget passes. So that's the bad system. And what's happening now is the House is saying, if you did not identify that earmark before we get to conference, then we're not going to, it can't be passed. Now, hopefully that will help with some of the transparency matters. But that still leaves the constitutional two-thirds vote question that's really the primary focus of our lawsuit.
And often, at least when you're drafting legislation, you don't know how many votes you're going to get on it. Like that's
right.
You don't really know until you ask for those votes.
Right. I mean, that's what the whip process is supposed to be. You're supposed to have a pretty good idea, yeah. But, you know, people can change their minds. They can hold off for something else. They could have a package that they want. It gets, you know, you have 148 people who are each trying to get the best for their district, the best for their state, the best for their political future, all of this stuff. So you've got a lot of competing ideas going on at the same time, and you're never really quite sure until the vote's put on the board.
Well, to go back, though, is that this whole process, you know, where they are generalizing it, they've been a part of budgets for at least the 20 years that I've been following public policy
sure.
in the state of Michigan. Why is it that no one else is challenged?
Well, for a while, it was because nobody else would have standing. So the
standing as in like no one really can, like no one's really harmed by these things. So therefore, no one can challenge.
Right. In the law, we have this idea called standing, and it means who really has the incentive to fight a lawsuit. Mm-hmm. So as a matter of federal constitutional law and federal standing law, typically taxpayers do not have standing. Okay, so
even if your thing is unconstitutional, and if it's an unconstitutional spending of your money, you're not especially harmed.
Yeah, let's say we know that a $5,000 Pentagon hammer is being spent illegally. Okay, you or I, we both know it. Mm. We cannot go into court and say that that harms us because there's 330 million people.
340 now.
340. And it is considered too generalized of a grievance and that the courts don't want to get involved in the day-to-day politics. And Michigan, until the I can't remember the year of the case, maybe 2012, had a federal standing rules. So we had no taxpayer standing. Mm-hmm. Now, there was a law that existed, but what didn't have any effect, which allows places like the Mackinac Center, a civic protection group, to challenge unconstitutional or illegal state expenditures. And so when Michigan's standing law changed, that allowed that statute to come into effect and for us to be able to bring this kind of suit. And so that was one factor was just for the longest time, nobody had standing to bring a suit. The second problem is it was an immense amount of legal research in order to get us to the point of to where we can understand all of this stuff. There, as I said.
Why? It seems like a simple constitutional language, simple rule.
Well, you are correct that it does. However, there was a area of law that developed in the mid-40s that was before Michigan's current constitution. There's a question of how much impact it has in interpreting our 1963 constitution. The general rule was that the courts could figure out what a public purpose is. And why that term matters is it's sort of the opposite of private purpose. Remember, Section 30 prevents appropriations that are either for a local or private purpose that don't have two-thirds vote. So, well, what's a private purpose versus a public purpose? And the thing that developed in the mid-40s was really who gets to decide that question. It comes into effect a lot in public use decisions for eminent domain. It comes into they used to call it taxation decisions as to what you are or are not allowed to tax for. This was developing from Justice Cooley in 1873. And so this question of, all right, is it the legislature's decision or is it the judiciary's decision?
That is to say, sorry, to try and summarize what's going on. It's like, okay, the section of the law says it's for local or private purpose.
Correct.
But there, which means that for public purposes, just the normal rules apply, simple majorities for voting approval. So what's the difference between a private and a public purpose? It's like, well, if the legislature says that it's a public purpose, it's a public purpose. Or it's the question of, does the legislature get to make that determination or the judiciary?
Correct. So if we treat, if we give this to the legislature and they just have to pass a law with a simple majority that says, by the way, we designate this as a public purpose, then that two-thirds vote really goes out the window because they can just deem anything that they want to spend money on to be a public purpose.
That is, this constitutional rule only applies when we want it to.
Correct. So then the question is, okay, well, how has Michigan treated public purpose tests throughout its history? And in particular, how has it treated it as when we're giving it to a what we'll call a private entity. So let this started, I said, 1873. At the time, Michigan was in the middle of, as was the rest of the country, railroad mania. Okay, we got to build railroads. This is the key to the future. Got to have it. And there was some trouble that Michigan had ran into after the there was a collapse in the 1830s, maybe it was 1840s. The point being is that Michigan had this internal improvement. Everybody wanted to build canals. Everybody wanted to build railroads. Michigan.
Railroad mania and canal crazy.
Right. Exactly. And so at the time, Michigan did that. Well, then we had a bank failure and Michigan got wiped out. And it caused all kinds of financial turmoil. And so in the next constitution, it was a lot harder to do any of these projects, particularly when they were given to private entities. So when private entities get money from the state, there's been always been in Michigan since 1850 a lot more scrutiny paid to it. So in 1873, there was a question of, okay, can cities give these money bonds to private railroads? Justice Cooley, after I think it was a full week of argument, they argued for five straight days. There was four justices on the court at the time. Justice Cooley wrote an opinion, People v. Salem, essentially saying, no, they cannot. That this is beyond the scope of the taxing power of the state. That taking money from a private person and giving it to B, you, the railroad, is unconstitutional under Michigan's constitution. Mm-hmm. And so, go ahead.
And in that, and the basic principle there is that the state government has an inherent limitation on it on its ability as just a republic. That's supposed to serve the public benefit. You can't just take money from some taxpayers and give them to other private entities. Like that does not serve the public purpose.
Correct. Now he did say that you could do this if you got enough votes. Exactly as the Constitution laid it out. If you had the correct amount of votes, and the people could create a constitution where they could do this, but that the general rule was as a matter of constitutional law that they could not. So this is largely the defense, this public purpose economic benefit, essentially the Keynesian economics of I just throw money in the air,
somebody all
grabs it, spends it, and then it multiplies itself and we all live happier.
Yeah, and we're all better off for that expenditure.
So that's the basic economic theory that's supporting this. Well, we have constitutional case law up until from 1873 all the way up through the 1963 Constitution saying, oh, that's not what we believe here in Michigan. That doesn't work. We don't ascribe to that. That is not a public purpose. And then when we got to the 1963 Constitution, there was three separate times that people tried to insert the ability of the state to do economic development, to follow this theory of your private company, here's some money.
To make it explicitly authorized that the state government can take money from some taxpayers and give them to private entities.
As a matter of fact, the governor at the time, during the Constitutional Convention, wrote a letter and said, hey, I want this ability. He wrote it to the Constitutional Convention. The next day, that was put before the Constitutional Convention delegates, and they were at the time a rather princely sum of $100 million they were going to put in the Constitution to allow economic development money to be given out as needed in order to, you know, maybe entice factories or try and create new new areas of manufacture or whatever. The delegates said no to a vote of about 40 in favor to 100 against. And then they were asking.
So that probably wasn't a partisan.
No, it was not. It was a Republican-ish convention, but it wasn't. They didn't have that kind of majority. So there was mostly the Democratic Party minority was in favor at the time. But again, it was a bipartisan rejection. And then there was two other separate times during the Constitutional Convention that people tried to put this in, and they all failed. And so you ended up with not one, not two, but three failures to explicitly allow this theory of let's give money to private things, to private parties, and good things will happen.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we get past that Constitutional Convention, and all of a sudden, people still want to do this. You know, this is the height
of...
It's
a perennial political desire.
Like, it is.
We set up the legislative districts. They naturally have an incentive to want to bring back home money to their district, or even to give money to private actors in the name of jobs and economic growth. That's a natural political desire.
And it's also usually a reaction to factory A, B, or C moved here to 140 jobs with them or something along those lines. And so what was driving the Constitutional Convention debates would be like a Muskegon factory shut down and moved somewhere else and it cost 400 jobs. Now, as you know, I mean, what's the number of jobs in the state right now?
More than 4 million, fewer than 5.
Okay. And so 400 is just an absolute drop in the bucket. But to a politician, you know, defending a district, and this is, of course, before term limits, you know, they have this hurts. This is a bad headline. Their newspapers are reporting on it and so forth. And so, you know, they're very concerned about these kinds of things. So this was during that time period where some of the auto jobs were starting to matriculate south. And, you know, people in Michigan were, you know, we've got to stop this. We've got, you know, those darn southern states and their no right to work laws and, you know, better areas and better laws to deal with, or whatever the reason was that they were drawing them. They were just, you know, at the time thinking that it was all financial incentives. So, you know, we still wanted to, certain forces wanted to do this in Michigan, despite the fact that really the Constitution prohibited it. Mm. And so you developed some case law afterwards, the courts, and we set this out in our brief at length, really did a poor job of analyzing the constitutional history and the CONCON history because they kept
their constitutional convention.
Yes, thank you. And they kept finding ways to work around these prohibitions to try and allow this stuff because the courts were feeling the social pressure of and the political pressure of trying to deal with this. So you might see, you know, I can give you an example that isn't quite economic.
Let's move on because I think we've covered a lot of the history of this, and explain why it's an important principle. It's like the state is supposed to benefit the whole state. Mm-hmm. There are different rules when you're trying to apply to just local governments and driving. And the way that they've found the loophole around those voting requirements is by saying that anything's a public purpose when we say it's a public purpose, and therefore these normal rules apply. But I guess I want to cover, like, that's a good constitutional case, but isn't there a more practical case for why we shouldn't want our lawmakers to pass these district grants? I mean,
they're bad policy in that it really goes to power of who's got it. So if you're the chairman, you're going to get way more grants than backbencher Bob, who's, you know, just doesn't have the political pull that you do. And all of a sudden, you know, you're ending up with certain districts doing better because you kind of make agreements and certain places get hurt because of it. And this is, you know, goes back all the way to the 1850s Constitution. We really would like this stuff to apply generally. We would like this to apply across the board.
We want our legislators to care about what benefits the state as a whole, not
their district in particular.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's it. I've seen, by the way, some really gross earmarks in the last couple of cycles. You know, there's a $20 million one that the state has rescinded that the recipient was getting $550,000. The chair, oh, by the way, when they got their $20 million earmark, the charity didn't exist yet. So you still had that thing to exist. Now, that one has been repealed. There's another one about doing space in the UP, rocket launches. That person is afraid to come back into the state right now because they think they're going to be prosecuted by the attorney general. So, you know, a couple of these have not been very well vetted.
Yeah, but I guess, I mean, the way that I understand that is that it's only, like, while we are arguing that it's unconstitutional because they didn't get two-thirds chamber, it's only something where it's like you've given a lawmaker some money so that they give you money from the taxpayer, a direct quid pro quo that would be illegal and that people should worry about. That's really tough to prove.
Yeah, I mean, that is difficult to prove. These aren't necessarily, I think, that they have to give money to it. It's the Department of Labor and Economic Opportunity has some oversight abilities, whether or not these things are truly doing a public purpose or not. You know, the legislature claims that they are just by saying that they passed the law, but they give LEO some and other grant recipients. So there would be other agencies that would have this responsibility to check and make sure that the public purpose is actually being served, that these things aren't a scam.
Yeah. By the way, that's something that I appreciated about that House bill to increase the transparency is that they actually asked legislators when they're approving these district grants to make a case for why this serves the public's benefit. Because, I mean, look, these things are complicated. Maybe there's a case that giving money to your district actually benefits the state as a whole. At least make that case. And this gives legislators a chance to do that.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes you get, you know, your edge case is, okay, what about an airport or how about a highway in this particular portion? Or, you know, would a... So you get sort of things like that, you know, those kinds of questions. And those get to be interesting, but... most of the time, what you're seeing, these people fill in the blanks, you know. And by the way, a very interesting dynamic has been that the House is now requiring this. The amount of earmarks requested has gone through the roof again. We're at $4 billion, and we don't even know what the Senate wants because the Senate isn't abiding by these guidelines yet. And so, you know, everybody who thinks that they might get an earmark is putting them in is front loading them. So you're really seeing the numbers jump up. Hopefully we won't see that many come out the back end.
If you are successful with this lawsuit, why is Michigan a better place?
Well, it's a better place because, again, this myopia of I'm going to take care of my district because this benefits me and I'm going to get reelected. As opposed to I'm worrying about the state, it becomes a less powerful, it becomes less likely because if we're successful, if you can't do the earmarks because you've got to get so many votes to do it, then you're going to see hopefully a better budget come out, a budget that is a little bit more focused on the state's needs as opposed to the politicians' needs.
Let me try and restate that,
please,
which is that we set up this government to benefit the public. I mean, this is basic principles of our Constitution. But we also know that our lawmakers are people, too, which is why we have rules like two-thirds approval for local and private acts. If you are successful, we get our legislators who are going to act like we want them to, in ways that benefit the public, that we try to rescind that extra political incentive for them to be more self-interested. This refocuses them back to the laws that benefit everyone, not just the people in their own districts.
Yes, that is the hope,
and that's a good thing too, because we don't want our our money, our the taxpayer money that we give to the state government to be divvied up based simply on who's the most powerful. Correct. We do want lawmakers to say, look, we're taxing people because there's important public business that has to be done. Let's make sure that we're focused on what on the projects that benefit the public.
Sure. And if the, you know, high school in, I'll just pick a random city, Troy, needs a swimming pool, well, great. They can do that. They can do their own bonding. They can, you know, the voters there can decide if that's important to them. We shouldn't be having a state representative, you know, charging that to everybody else in the state.
Well, I would go even broader than that. If legislators decide that it would be in the public benefit to that we had more swimming pools, they'd be perfectly entitled to set up a program, establish criteria to determine which swimming pool projects are the best, have people apply, and the best swimming pool projects get funded.
Sure.
That's perfectly reasonable, too.
Yep.
So where's this lawsuit go?
Well, right now it's in the Court of Claims. Today we file...
which is the court about state matters.
Sure. The Court of Claims is only about state matters. From there, you would go to the Court of Appeals, and from there, you would go to the Michigan Supreme Court. We are seeking something called a preliminary injunction. Preliminary injunction asks that the status quo remain. In other words, don't spend the money until such time as the case is decided. And we are asking Court of Claims judge to enter one of those injunctions. Whoever wins or loses will likely appeal to the Court of Appeals, and then it would go to the Michigan Supreme Court. As a matter of Michigan constitutional law, the Michigan Supreme Court is the ultimate arbiter of that, and so probably a year and a half, we'll know our decision for sure.
Well, Pat, good luck on your attempts to shift the Overton window.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Overton Window, a podcast from the Mackinac Center. Please subscribe and rate. For more, check us out at www.mackinac.org. That's Mackinac with a C, like the island.